Welcome to North Square Investments Active Insights Podcast. North Square Investments is dedicated to bringing differentiated active investment strategies to financial advisors and investors through our multi-boutique asset management platform. Today, Mark Goodwin, Chief Executive Officer of North Square Investments, Brian Allen, Chief Investment Officer with C.S. McKee, and John Cassidy, Chief Investment Officer with Red Cedar Investment Management, will discuss the fixed income market and the advantages these two portfolio management teams bring to North Square's Core Plus Bond strategy. C.S. McKee is an affiliate of North Square, and Red Cedar is a partner firm in the North Square platform. Each firm is a sub-advisor for the North Square Core Plus Bond Fund, ticker STTIX. Mark, Brian, John, we look forward to your discussion.
Thanks, Diane. As you mentioned, at North Square, we seek out best-in-class active managers for our platform, and our partners at C.S. McKee and Red Cedar have proven repeatable approaches to fixed income investing. As sub-advisors for our Core Plus Bond strategy, C.S. McKee manages the investment-grade component of the portfolio, and Red Cedar manages the plus or non-investment-grade component. North Square determines the allocation between the sub-advisors, and currently 65% of the portfolio is allocated to investment-grade securities, with 35% allocated to non-investment-grade. Brian, to start with you, can you discuss the overall strategy and objectives of the Core Plus Bond Fund?
Certainly. The marriage of McKee and Red Cedar combined demonstrated strength in their respective areas. McKee as a purely investment-grade, true core investment manager with a very attractive long-term risk-adjusted rates of return, and Red Cedar with a fairly unique approach on the plus side of the equation, also with a long history of adding consistent value. So we think the combination will be an attractive offering for a fairly wide range of retail and institutional investors.
Can you talk about your investment approach to selecting investment-grade bonds and building that portfolio component?
McKee has always been a bottom-up, primarily focused shop. We don't make large interest rate calls or quality calls. I'm very much focused on quality and liquidity overall. We spend 80% of our time analyzing relative value in the investment grade universe. Offsetting that, and what was really the most unique portion of our focus is in the government agency space, where we find a universe of securities well beyond what appears in most benchmarks. And that has really allowed us to add consistent value without taking additional credit risk. And again, that's a nice foundation, a nice piece to marry with the unique approach that Red Cedar has in the high yield space.
Thanks, Brian. John, you have a broad range of assets in your investment universe. Can you talk about your approach to building the non-investment grade sleeve of the strategy?
Yeah, sure, Mark. It's kind of born out of, I think if you take a page out of the institutional investment consulting framework, recently they've developed a category called multi-asset credit, which is kind of, it's really designed so that managers can rotate between different parts of the credit spectrum where they find value, just so that they can make tactical moves, that sort of thing. And typically they'll maybe rotate between high yield, CLOs, maybe emerging market. And it gives the manager who's in the trenches the ability to go where they find value. So if you think about that from the institutional world, what we're trying to do here in our product is find those areas. We would say, well, we're rotating between traditional high yield. Think about, I'm going to date myself here, Michael Milken, junk bonds, as they used to say back in the day. So traditional high yield, if there is such a name there, structured product or securitized, if you want to go back to the financial crisis and think about all the mortgage bonds and so forth, definitely there's some opportunities there that we can rotate between. And then the third prong of that would be preferred securities. What I would say is that there's a lot of inefficiencies in kind of these three prongs that we play in. The first thing we try to do is we want to ascertain relative value between each of the three. Where's the best risk reward kind of thing? But then it's also, so that's from a top-down approach. But then it also, there's no substitute for a good old-fashioned bottom-up security selection, doing your analysis there. So once we decide kind of which of those three sectors represent the best relative value, I'll give you an example here. On the high yield side, we utilize a three-factor credit model that was developed here by our senior credit strategist, Brad Phillips. So the three factors we look at, and this is all looking at statistically driven numbers, looking back historically, we're looking at number one, just good old fashioned fundamentals, then a relative value factor that gets applied, and then a probability of default. And what that does is we've got all kinds of data going back historically, run it through the model, helps us determine through the lens of those three factors where there is value in traditional high yield. And by that, I mean, it kind of winnows it down to, well, what sector, what rating, and what industry, and then what tenor. And then it helps us then fine tune and go and look in wherever it tells us, okay, what names do we want to look at? Sometimes you find that, oh, well, something looks cheap in the model for a reason. You don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. But it really helps us, kind of with a laser-like focus, decide where we want to go and put high yield into the portfolio. And then from there, I guess I'd say on the securitized side, a lot of bottom-up fundamental analysis, best, worst-case scenarios, that kind of thing goes into it. And what we end up with at the end of the day here is a portfolio that we think gives you a lot of reward relative to the risk that you're undertaking. And that's the goal here on the high yield or the plus side of the equation.
John and Brian, I view both of your teams as kind of all stars in your respective spaces of fixed income. I'll start with you, Brian, first. How do the two teams coordinate so the two sleeves are complementary and work towards the common objectives of the fund?
Well, a lot of communication between the teams, running the total portfolio through our systems to measure overlap in securities or sector in industry weightings. And then when it comes to portfolio duration, really Red Cedar takes the lead on that portion of the risk exposure.
John, similarly, how do you view risk management for the overall portfolio? And can you envision a situation where the two teams might have different views on the market and how that would be resolved?
Yeah, risk management, I mean, certainly as Brian alluded to, takes a lot of coordination. We're looking not only at our sleeve of the portfolio, but at the overall portfolio itself. We at Red Cedar, we're taking the lead on the interest rate side of the equation or duration. How do we want to position ourselves? And then we think almost as important as, and actually certainly I think at this moment in time, is key rate duration. Where do you want to be positioned along the yield curve? So definitely looking at that, keeping a close eye on it. The reality of the situation is, as Brian said, they don't tend to take a lot of interest rate risk, you know, and I hope I'm not putting words in his mouth, but I think they tend to be agnostic on the duration relative to the benchmark, whereas we're comfortable doing that. With all that being said, though, we're not sitting here taking, you know, pretty huge swings at the bat with regard to duration. Like right now, for instance, we do think that, you know, you're not being paid to take a ton of interest rate risk. So we're slightly short the duration of the benchmark. So the Bloomberg Ag Index is about 6.1 years duration, and we're holding this thing at like 5.8 years duration. So about 5% short relative to the benchmark. That's generally as wide as we will get relative to the benchmark. I know the Morningstar category for Core Plus would allow it to go wider, and maybe there would be opportunistic moments in time to do that. But for our purposes, we're generally going to be 90 to 110% duration of the benchmark. And then going back to, if I could for just a second, to discuss the long end of the yield curve, there's no term premium in the yield curve. If you think about 10 and 30 years out, then we just think that you're not getting paid to take a lot of interest rate risk in here. And so that could change. You could have a risk off moment in the yield curve pancakes, or perhaps the Fed in their infinite wisdom comes in at some point in time. We've seen them do it before with regard to, yield curve control, that sort of thing. But that is not our base case at this moment, but certainly something that is definitely in the back of your mind as you try to manage the overall risk of the portfolio. And then I guess if you want to take risk management, you know, a further level, going back to our three-factor model on credit, certainly, we're sitting here looking at fundamentals and probability of default. Those are keys for us. So that's why we use the credit model that we use. And right now, we're finding value in the single B space in terms of rating category of high yield, and then opportunistically in triple Cs. That's where we find that you're getting a lot of bang for your buck right now, currently. Double Bs are just, they're very, very expensive. Overall, high yield though, when you want to talk about risk management, you know, the balance sheet, this is not 2015, 2016, balance sheets are pretty well shored up. So you cannot just look at spreads. You have to look at that fundamental piece of the balance sheets and how these companies look at this point in time.
Thank you, John. Brian, John, the Fed has been easing rates. The rate of inflation has improved. Economic growth has been resilient, but federal deficits remain challenging. We have significant geopolitical tensions and the new administration taking office in the U.S. That seems like a lot. I'm going to start with you first, Brian. Where do you see the markets? I was going to ask about currently, but we only have 2 weeks left in the year. What's your outlook on the markets for 2025 in terms of rate cuts, the economy, and just broad general thoughts?
I think the market is close to fairly valued at this point. Real yields are right around 2%, which has historically indicated some good value, good purchase opportunities. But we think the market has realized that growth will continue into 2025. The odds for recession have come down. The number of Fed rate cuts priced into the market has come down by 4 or so. End of the year 2025, the market's now expecting terminal rate of about 3.75. That's fully 100 basis points north of the lows we saw in September, just prior to the Fed's 50 basis point rate cut. And we think, frankly, at the sector level, we'll continue to find, in our space, better value in the agency market versus the overall level of spreads and relative value in corporate credit. We're in the lower decile of yield spreads versus treasuries in the investment grade market going back 20, 30 years or more. I think the enthusiasm over the new administration has been fully priced in, both in stocks, almost fully in stocks, and pretty much the case is true in investment grade corporate credit. Tariffs, deregulation, anything that can benefit the bottom line, I think has been carried forth into relative value. And frankly, the momentum of the markets has carried spreads fairly tight. So again, we think we are slightly underweight corporate credit at this point in time. Had a more significant overweight in the mortgage market for the first time in many years, but those values have improved as well. So we go into the next year with a slight overweight to the agency market, and that's a combination of agency debentures and agency mortgages, a little defensive on corporate credit and duration, slightly short of the benchmark, not to the 5% level, but for the overall portfolio, I'm quite happy with a defensive bias with respect to portfolio duration, given the fact that the trend in yield certainly is higher. And I do think we'll find out tomorrow, but on the 18th is the next FOMC meeting. The market has fully priced in at 96% last I looked, rate cut again in December, but the commentary following the meeting should point towards a little more cautious approach, reiterating the fact that the Fed is data dependent. And as we've seen, the consumer who has long since spent all of the stimulus money that was provided in 2020 and 21, it certainly kickstarted the economy. Unemployment remains fairly low. Job growth is now slowing, but still positive. Wage growth is slightly above the rate of inflation. So consumers are gradually recovering purchasing power. But for those who were fortunate enough to own a home and had the chance to refinance in 2020, for those who are net savers and have money invested in the stock market, the combination, the wealth effect, is really driving consumer demand. And we think that while it does slow a little next year, it's a long way from recession. So the Fed should take a more measured approach to stimulating the economy.
John, I'm going to direct the next two-part question to you. Are you finding valuations to be broadly at attractive levels, or does this vary across various segments of the fixed income market? And where are you seeing the best opportunities to put new capital to work today in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I mean, certainly credit spreads are at pretty frothy levels if you just want to look at them in a vacuum. But I do want to go back to and answer this question partially with kind of what, you know, how you posed the question to Brian there. I think you do have to take into account circumstances about what's going on in the U.S. economy. So we agree with Brian that, yeah, spreads are probably are pretty tight right now. But look, we think the Fed has abdicated their responsibility when you think about their mandate for price stability and full employment. The Fed is sitting here cutting rates when we are at full employment and we are experiencing 3% real GDP growth in the U.S. So 3% real GDP growth is quite a bit above what most economists would describe as U.S. potential GDP. Economists would probably say potential GDP is 2-2.25%. We've been clipping along at 3%, and this is quarters after all the fiscal stimulus, or I should say after all the stimulus that we received from COVID. Why are we doing this? Why are we able to clip along at 3%? Has to do with the deficits that you alluded to. And so far, I've seen neither political party through the election cycle was willing to really address that. Now it looks like the Trump administration is going to have a sweep and they're going to be able to do a lot of things that they want to do. And quite frankly, I just don't see the fiscal largesse really swelling at this point. And we'll see where that gets us. But for right now, I just think it's going to carry on with stronger growth than probably many people expect. And you've got the Fed playing a role by continuing to cut rates. In fact, if you look at all the countries in the world that represent 80% of GDP growth globally, all of them are in a rate cutting cycle right now. So you've got this tailwind of monetary policy going on globally. And I should go back and say the only ones who aren't cutting are ironically Japan. They've had a secular stagnation for decades now. In Russia, and that's a completely different story. But the fact remains, you've got monetary stimulus going on. I think you're going to continue to have fiscal stimulus in the U.S. And I think that that's just going to bode well for, even though maybe you won't get spread tightening per se in the sectors that we're looking at, but I do think that you're going to clip the coupon, you're going to clip the carry. And once again, we're paying attention to that probability of default in the way the balance sheets look right now. And so we think that you're still getting paid to be in a single B space and opportunistically in triple Cs. Then the other place I would say where there's value would be is in preferred securities. That's another lever that we can pull on. These tend to be crossover credits, kind of straddling that line of triple B and double B. And if you think about the deregulation that Trump and Doge wants to bring into the business world with it, you know, beginning in 2025, we think that deregulation, the biggest beneficiary of that is going to be the banking and finance industry. And we think that just bodes well for them to really increase their earnings. And then if you think about what we think is going on, this is a mid-cycle reflationary boom that we're going through. We think the yield curve continues to steepen. And that definitely helps net interest margins of banks if you continue to get the steepening of the yield curve. So that kind of sums up where we think we're finding relative value. You know, really the other place I'd say we go is CMBS. People talk about office space and what's going on out there in the world. We can really dig down, do some analysis in CMBS. We do loan level detail. We look at the properties in every CMBS deal we own, and then we look at the structure of the deal and how quickly the deal is delevering. So we're able to find, we'll call it 2012 to 2014 vintage CMBS deals that are delevering, that are amortizing now, as opposed to just waiting for a balloon payment to cause trouble. Those are the places where we find value in the market right now.
Thank you, John. Brian, you and your team are active investment managers with a focus on bottom-up analysis. How are you positioning the investment-grade portfolio of the North Square Core Plus Bond Fund currently?
Again, with the most recent overweight to the agency sector in particular, we had a fair amount of rise in volatility going into the election, which historically is the case, followed by resolution almost regardless of who was the eventual winner or the outcome from the elections. But volatility then tends to trade off. As I mentioned before, our focus in agencies is a fairly small portion of most performance benchmarks, but the agency market itself is so much larger, like 8 or 9 times the size of what appears in the popular benchmarks. and callable securities in particular, even some certificates, negotiable certificates of deposit, were trading at fairly attractive spreads, certainly against our universe of corporate securities. And we thought, well, it's a safe play, again, to ride the wave of volatility, to take that negative convexity risk when we're being paid to do so. And then following the election, of course, we trended much lower in volatility. The VIX now with a 13 handle on it, the MOVE index, which is sort of the bond market equivalent of the VIX, is at the year-to-date lows, matching levels we saw back in April and May of this year. So spreads have tightened and we began to work out of those positions. We've always found that in this space in particular, one thing to go out and find securities that look attractive at any point in time, but we will also scale back risk when we feel that, the risks are outweigh the level of compensation we're receiving. So the portfolio right now is fairly streamlined in terms of where we're standing out relative to the benchmark, still in the agency space, but more in the mortgage area and more finding relative value with specific securities in the mortgage space, discount coupons with higher turnover rates, either due to borrower credit characteristics or geographic influences, and more in the premium space where there's some barriers to refinancing. So we really found that the barbell approach in the mortgage space has worked well this year, while some of the more current coupons, sort of the 3.5 to 4, 4.5 coupons, have lagged a bit.
Thank you, Brian. John, Red Cedar looks at relative value across various asset classes. How is the non-investment grade component currently positioned?
Yeah, so right now we are sitting at about 16% or so of the portfolio is in below investment grade, those traditional Michael Milken high yield bonds. We're about, call it 10, 11% preferred securities. So remember, those are those crossover securities, maybe triple B, double B type levels. The thing about preferred securities and corporate hybrids, I'll throw those into the mix there as well, is that there is, and it reminded me as Brian spoke about negative convexity, we are trying to manage against extension risk, right? There is that negative convexity risk in those types of securities, but we're very adept at managing that risk. So we're looking for structures that have high back-end coupons, that sort of thing, that kind of limit the extension risk in them. Then finally, the other piece of that is the securitized piece of it, with quite a bit of it coming in the CMBS world. I think all the things going on in commercial real estate, people, rightfully so, should be concerned about certain properties, office space, that sort of thing. But that's given us a little bit of a relative value play in the CMBS world. But once again, there's a lot of bottom-up analysis that goes into that. But in the meantime, we're taking advantage of valuations that look cheaper relative to maybe some ABS or some non-agency mortgage-backed securities out there. The other piece that I would mention as well that we have in the portfolio, we do have a tail risk hedging strategy. We are not blind to the risks out there. And as tail risk kind of implies, it's something that just comes out, you know, think of a black swan or something that comes out of left field that you can't really predict. So therefore, even though volatility has remained really pretty level and not too out of control or anything, we are not blind to the fact that at any moment there could be something when the wall of worry, you've got a war going on in Ukraine, you've got unrest in the Mideast with a regime that just got overthrown, and still you've got Israel and the Gaza Strip, you know, the war going on there. So we know that at any moment something could happen to throw everything out of whack. So we do have a tail risk hedging strategy that would benefit the portfolio if volatility were to spike. In that we've used this in other products through the years, and it's very effective. And you could say, well, maybe you should own 10 and 30 year treasuries, because with the flight to quality, when volatility spikes, 10 and 30 year treasuries would rally, and that would help your portfolio. But we look at 10 and 30 year treasuries right now as a very expensive hedge to have in your portfolio. So that's why we've got a hedge that takes advantage of an uptick in equity volatility if and when equity volatility does spike.
That's a good segue to the next question for you both. As you think about key concerns or risks that you're monitoring going forward, are there any ones that jump out as more likely or concerning than others, the geopolitical ones you've just summarized, but I'm thinking tariffs, or the application of tariffs across different industries, either impact on U.S. industries or any sovereigns. I know, John, you guys have had some sovereign exposure over time, but I mean, starting with Brian and then back to you, John, any broad risks that are top of mind?
Yeah, tariffs certainly, the not only the types of tariffs put in place, but the pace at which they're implemented. That's certainly a cautionary tale on the inflationary front. Despite the lows we saw in consumer prices middle of this year, the last several months, we've seen especially core inflation coming in at 0.3% per month. And the annualized rate is still firmly above 3%. We do think that improves, but the pace of improvement has slowed quite a bit, and congruent with our thoughts that we will not see a recession next year. We think just the demand side of the equation will keep inflation north of 2%. Of course, the Fed looks at PCE as their favored measure of inflation, but that's still running in the high twos. So I think, one, the market has correctly changed their outlook for the Fed's likely moves in 2025. And I think Fed commentary again tomorrow will be instrumental in, for the balance of this year, and sort of framing what risk they see in the growth and inflation part of the equation. Overseas, we heightened military situation in the Middle East, and the change now with Syria having finally undergone some change in leadership. That's sort of tossed up in the air. Iran, Russia, the U.S., there are Israel, a number of opposing forces looking to dictate or control how new leadership assumes control in Syria. And then ongoing, we certainly haven't forgotten about Russia and the Ukraine. Some talk about the fact that President-elect Trump will push Zelensky to negotiate an end to the war. It seems to have been unlikely to occur in the past. It'll be interesting to see if any more effective this time around, if the threat of lack of supply and military hardware and weapon systems will sway that conversation or not. But we have certainly enough on the international front. And then, as John mentioned earlier, most of the developed world is now cutting rates. So there's a pro-inflationary force, not so much for those countries in particular, because they're certainly, the U.S. is the exception to the rule these days with economic performance and financial market performance. But the extent to which that influences inflation in the U.S. and to the extent to which it affects the inflows to the U.S. fixed income market, demand for treasuries, corporates, and mortgages. We'd also agree that if anything, with the fact that we're running full employment and still running deficits, which are likely to increase going forward, there is growing concern, as there has been for a while, but growing concern that the credit quality of the U.S. is certainly suffering somewhat. And that I think has that coupled with residual inflationary concerns as the back end, as probably the least attractive portion of the yield curve in the U.S.
Thank you, Brian. John, maybe pivoting closer to home for a minute. You know, some of the risks we're hearing about a year or so ago are commercial real estate, rise of private credit, but commercial real estate was really a focus area. Anything closer to home in terms of risks that cause you to stay awake at night?
I would just reiterate, you know, maybe that what is the Trump administration going to do? We've done some analysis, and like, well, while we should be concerned about tariffs,
I would argue this, that the Trump tariffs of 2018 and 2019 did not exactly derail the U.S. economy.
In fact, we had, you know, pretty decent economic growth even during that episode. And everyone was screaming about inflation. Oh, inflation's going to spike as a result. And it was flat to down during that time period. I think tariffs are an interesting sideshow. And look, I'm not trying to dismiss it, but I think you need to broaden out what you're looking at in terms of what will happen with economic growth and inflation.
In 2018 and 2019, the Chinese currency was devalued, so the currency move actually absorbed some of the tariffs that took place.
We did some analysis. Those tariffs amounted to $80 billion on what was then a $22 trillion economy. So not exactly a huge part of the U.S. economy. I think it calculated out to like 0.35% of the U.S. economy. That being said, we're about to go into round two of tariffs, and we'll see. I think Trump tends to use them as negotiating ploys to get what he wants. I don't really believe that, you know, he's going to impose tariffs on Canada and on Mexico, but maybe I'll be proved wrong. Maybe it's in the cards that there's an additional 10% tariff placed on Chinese goods. But once again, that's not going to be an economy killer at all. I think what would concern me would be mass deportations. I know that's, you know, probably political football to talk about deporting people. But I think if you look at part of what has grown the U.S. economy is the growth in the workforce over the last 3 or 4 years under the Biden administration, where you had probably 2.5-3 million immigrants come into this country per year during the Biden years. That most certainly had an effect on exceptional U.S. growth. And so if you take that away, you know, mass deportations could cause the economy to slow dramatically. And that could be inflationary as well. Is you know, so that stagflationary scenario could be, it's not our base case, but something I keep an eye on. I think that, you know, just maybe to broaden out the discussion a little bit, I saw an interesting thing the other day. It's like of the G7 nations, there's a G7 meeting in Europe earlier this summer, and there's a picture, a famous picture of them all the G7 world leaders. Really, there's only one left standing. If you think about it, Biden is gone or will be gone.
You've got Scholz from Germany.
You've got Trudeau in Canada on the ropes. Macron, you know, the French government has fallen. Really, the last person standing of the G7 from a meeting earlier this summer is Giorgia Meloni from Italy. So just the idea that there's maybe unrest in government in Western democracies, that would be a cause for concern, and we'll see how that all plays out. So these are things we keep our eyes on and that could upset the apple cart. And then I'll just say, I think finally, the fiscal situation in the U.S., as I said earlier, I don't think that we're going to slow down our spending. I think it's going to keep going and going. And I guess for right now, I think it was Jason Trenner at Strategus who stated this. He said, for now, we remain bullish until the bill comes due. No telling when that bill can come due. The market, I guess, will tell the U.S. government when it can no longer spend that much. But that would certainly be the thing out there that could really cause problems down the road.
Thank you, John. Brian, a final question I'll direct to you. How do you see this type of active core plus strategy being best positioned in a diversified portfolio of an individual investor?
Well, I think it runs the gamut, or sort of crosses the line for offering an individual investor some measure of diversification versus what's just an ever-growing allocation to equities, whether money's being added or just the appreciation in that market over the last few years. And real yields in core fixed income are historically attractive, though the absolute level of yields is, you know, fair. I think the addition of a very risk-focused core plus or a plus strategy to the equation really does offer the chance to boost income. And when coupled with our fairly low volatility approach, what you've got in the end is even more attractive rates of current income. And the true benefit of active management, uncovering value in areas that a passive approach to core plus wouldn't find, and ultimately a fairly consistent stream of income going forward.
Brian, John, thank you for joining me today. This has been a great discussion.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Thank you for tuning in to our North Square Active Insights podcast. For more information on North Square Investments, our partners, and investment solutions, please visit our website at www.northsquareinvest.com. Nothing contained in this communication constitutes tax, legal, or investment advice. Investors must consult their tax advisor or legal counsel for advice and information concerning their particular situation. This podcast contains certain statements that may include forward-looking statements. Although C.S. McKee and Red Cedar believe that the expectations reflected in these forward-looking statements are reasonable, they do involve assumptions, risks, and uncertainties, and these expectations may prove to be incorrect. Actual events could differ materially from those anticipated in these forward-looking statements as a result of a variety of factors. You should not place undue reliance on these forward-looking statements. This podcast reflects the views and opinions of C.S. McKee and Fred Cedar as of the date herein, which are subject to change at any time based on market and other conditions. We disclaim any responsibility to update these views. These views should not be relied on as investment advice or an indication of trading intentions.